Welcome to Federal Insights, sponsored by Okta on Federal News Network.
As much as any agency in the federal government, Customs and Border Protection needs to know who people really are, in person or in cyberspace. That's why it has a strong program for identity and access management. For more, I spoke with CBP's Acting Chief Information Security Officer, Scott Davis. Let's begin with ID and access management. What are the goals that you have? What are the applications that are important to have good access and ID management? Tell us, you know, where it all starts for CBP.
Well, the goal is to protect our information and our information systems. So we have several applications. Some of them are provided by the Department of Homeland Security's Continuous Diagnostics and Mitigation Program, CDM program. For example, we have SailPoint, which is, again, provided by the CDM program. And that's to, again, make sure our access is restricted to only people who have authorization. And it's very granular. We can go down to the role level, specific user roles, and those are established within each one of the applications. So it's a very fine and granular control. So it's making sure that the right people have the right information at the right time. Other applications we have provide simplified sign-on or single sign-on. That's to reduce the amount of user IDs and passwords that people have to remember. And so that's another goal, is making sure we're doing things securely, but also making sure that people don't have to continue to remember hundreds or thousands of passwords.
And what about, if this applies, there are a lot of public-facing applications that CBP has. In fact, I was on one of them just last night renewing my global entry card, and it uses login.gov, I think, is the right. The reference point there. But is that also part of the ID and access management set up for the agency to apply to those public-facing situations?
It is. So CBP, as you mentioned, has lots and lots of public-facing applications. Some of them are very simple and don't require actual logins. It's just for informational purposes. But you mentioned global entry. So there's trusted traveler programs is what they're called. So people are familiar with TSA PreCheck, global entry, things like that. Those require identity proofing. So you would have to provide either a known traveler number, your passport information, passport number to verify who you are. And then we do utilize the General Services Administration, GSA's login.gov. So that's the ability for people to create an identity, a user ID. And then there's multi-factor authentication. So it's, you provide your ID, and then you can either get a text or a phone call with a number to verify who you are.
Yeah, so then there's a pretty healthy interagency situation there to be able to verify, say, against the State Department database using the GSA's login.gov and maybe a couple of others, as the case might be.
Yes, we've got feeds that come into our identity platform. So it's holistic, whether it's internal users, external users, such as general public folks coming into access, again, like global entry systems, as well as trade partners for Customs and Border Protection and things of that nature. So we have feeds that come in from various federal partners. We have Treasury, we have, as you mentioned, State Department, GSA. So those data feeds come in with information for the user population that bounce against our identity platform so that we can make sure that people that are accessing our systems are authorized to access, again, both internal and external.
And for people coming into the United States by various modes and by various routes and directions, does any of this apply to people that are accessing United States services from foreign countries?
Well, it's generally for our users, like Trusted Traveler. You have to be a U.S. citizen, a U.S. citizen to access Trusted Traveler. There are other applications that are utilized, but not general public accessing those for people and are not accessing those systems per se.
And if you would maybe discuss the architecture of where all of these services and applications lie, that is to say, are they in CBP or DHS hosted data centers, or are you using cloud type services for a lot of this?
Well, CBP has a hybrid environment is what it's called. So we have both on-premises and we have cloud services, cloud service providers. So we have on-prem stuff that's providing our access, and we monitor and manage those services such as SailPoint. We have Okta, which is another identity provider. That's a cloud service. So it's basically a hybrid environment where we're doing cloud identity management as well as on-prem. So we have through Microsoft Active Directory is what it's called. And we have that structure with profiles built in primarily for our CBP federal and contract partner users. And it's also managed through, like I mentioned, Okta, which is the cloud service provider. So there's twofold pieces, and we're shifting more towards the cloud because there's enhanced security, there's resiliency, things of that nature. But currently we're in a hybrid environment is what it's called.
Got it. And maybe for a moment, talk about identity proofing a little bit more, because say if someone is applying for one of those trusted traveler services, the proofing comes in the form of other credentials that they already have that presumably they are authorized to have. But then there's also third-party kind of data. I was looking at what I had recorded for my account, and I found that I had key questions to answer, you know, your mother's maiden name, that kind of stuff.
Sure.
And that scene is changing. The technologies for doing that are changing with more to a live artificial intelligence type of entry as opposed to a fixed answer of yesteryear. So give us the update there, if you would.
Well, so right now, for CBP federal employees, as well as our contract partners, they go through a background investigation. So it's fairly extensive, and they get information through that background investigation for security clearances, things of that nature. And then they're presented with a personal identity verification or PIV card. So that's how they are identified, whether it's in person or accessing information systems. The identity proofing that you're discussing, people may understand it as far as if they've built an account for a bank, for example, or another application, and it asks them questions such as, what's the street that you grew up on, or what bank holds the loan for your automobile? Those are the services that are used to do the identity proofing to say, I am who I'm saying I am, when you're creating those accounts. And so those are services that are provided. You know, login.gov may ask those different questions as you're setting up accounts, or there's other ones. So that's giving that third party, as you mentioned, third party verification. And it is changing. We're not leveraging any of the newest pieces for that for our internal use. It's things that we're looking at as far as the future goes, though.
Scott Davis, Acting Chief Information Security Officer at Customs and Border Protection. We'll return with more of the interview after this short break. I'm Tom Temin.
President Biden's executive order on cybersecurity is a solid step toward creating a resilient cyber infrastructure for our nation. Okta and AWS can help agencies meet the cybersecurity executive mandates with a Zero Trust architecture that aligns to FedRAMP, NIST, and other standards. Together, Okta and AWS provide a vendor-neutral approach that enables MFA and identity management across endpoints, workflows, and supply chains. Learn more at okta.com/federal. That's okta.com/federal.
Welcome back to our interview with Scott Davis, Acting Chief Information Security Officer at Customs and Border Protection. Our topic is online identity and access management. And let's talk about Active Directory for the CBP internal users, which is the main focus here. And that has always been, you know, a reference point for who is who and who belongs in an organization and what they can access. How does your Active Directory, if that's what you use, fit into the ID and access management larger picture now?
Active Directory is established so that we have groups and policies so that it's set up for role-based access control. It can go down to a very granular level. It enables us to use the identity platform to ensure that people that are authorized to access can get access at the lowest level. So we've got, as I said, groups and policies established so that if it's a general user, they can access specific files, specific folders, things of that nature, as well as specific applications. It also ensures that we have people that have privileged access, so the system administrators, database administrators, something along those lines, that they have the ability to do the things that they need to do and nothing else.
And so, therefore, is your Active Directory cloud-hosted, or is it locally focused, locally hosted, rather? And that would have some impact on how you architect the whole thing and what kind of calls you need to have and traffic.
Sure. So, primarily, our Active Directory is on-premises. Again, we're shifting a lot of our infrastructure to the cloud. So, we're moving. It's part of our cloud migration process. That's not within the cybersecurity directorate, but it is something that cybersecurity is obviously involved in for the cloud security. But our primary instance of Active Directory is on-premises. Again, we're shifting towards cloud with just not only our applications, but the majority of our infrastructure as well.
And it might be useful to understand the workforce of Customs and Border Protection, because you've got, of course, headquarters and offices throughout, but then there's really a large contingency of field people, officers and so forth, that are out there on the hustings. And how does it all break down in terms of relative numbers or percentages? And then we can get into how you handle the mobile situation.
Sure. So there's many pieces of Customs and Border Protection. If you're not involved in CBP, you may not understand that we have obviously people that are on Border Patrol. We also have people that are doing air and marine operations. We have people that are working with trade. So there's people that are working with our trade partners as stuff comes in and out of the ports. We also have passenger folks, so the people that are flying in or cruise travels, people at the ports for that, things of that nature. So we have 68,000, I believe, is the current number of CBP employees. As you mentioned, we have contingents of folks that are at the headquarters, but then there's the vast majority of the people are across the nation and some people that are overseas that are working for Customs and Border Protection across the various things that I mentioned, whether it's Border Patrol, field operations, trade, things of that nature.
And a big topic now in ID, in proofing, and everything else is connected with cybersecurity is multi-factor authentication. Tell us your system for that and what are some of the factors and how you incorporate it all into the architecture. So, again, as you mentioned earlier, it's not some big pain for the people that need to log on over and over.
Well, we talked a little bit about login.gov. So that's a multi-factor platform that users that come in have the ability to create an account through login.gov. As they log in, it's giving them the option to get either a number sent to them via text or via phone message, something along those lines. So it's something that you're going to be randomly generating. For our internal users, they have that card, the PIV, and there's a chip on there with a certificate. So it's something you have and something you know. So they have the physical ID device, and then the something that they know is the PIN that they put in, the number that they put in each time they access the system or the application. So there's a couple different ways that we're using multi-factor authentication. And you talked about the platform. We have that tied into our identity platform. So as people use those multi-factors, we're leveraging an integrating application called Okta so that they can be provided with simplified sign-on or single sign-on, again, to reduce the number of times that they have to log into systems. So if you log in, you should be able to access multiple applications without having to continue to go through login after login after login. And so you've got that multi-factor once it's coming in, but this is also moving towards zero trust. So that's the latest buzzword, if you will, that's come out of cybersecurity. And it's an implementation of an architecture. Identity is one of the building blocks of that zero trust architecture. So it's making sure that we have trusted people accessing the information, as I mentioned before, the right information to the right people at the right time and nothing else. So it's minimizing the ability of accessing information that you're not authorized to. And it's also providing us the ability to compartmentalize whether it's the user's access, files, structure, things of that nature.
And do you have a way of monitoring what are regular habits of given users? That is to say, suppose I use these three applications day after day after day, and my single sign-on lets me get to those applications, no problem. But then suppose one day I need applications 4 and 5. Is there the possibility of a challenge response built into that if someone wants to go beyond what looks like their normal profile? Is that kind of thing kept and measured, and does it work that way?
Well, some of what you're talking about is user-based analytics. So we're moving towards that. We don't have an implementation as of yet, but we do have the restrictions where if a user wants to access an application that they don't currently have access to, there's a multi-step process for them to gain access to the application. They request it. It then goes to a second level authority, for example, a supervisor. So the user would request access to an application. Their supervisor would or should know whether or not that user should have access to it. And I mentioned down to the role, the user would request specific roles for each of those applications. And then the supervisor or second level authority would say whether or not that person should or should not have access, not just to the application, but each one of those specific roles, whether it's a simple user role, an elevated privilege like an admin, access to reports, things of that nature. And then there's another level for a lot of our applications where it's the application owner, so the business owner of each one of those applications, then has the final approval to say whether or not the person should or should not have access to that application. For example, if you have a general user, a Border Patrol agent that wants access to something that's in a completely different area that a Border Patrol agent doesn't regularly need access to, it would cause questions for both the supervisor and then, of course, the application owner, and those can be rejected. We also use this platform for recertification. So It's not just a one and done. So even though you ask for access to the application, there's a continual recertification. It's twice a year currently. And then there's spot checks and things of that nature to go back. And each one of the applications owners goes through and verifies whether or not their user community should continue to still have access. That also goes down to the supervisor. The supervisor then also says whether or not a person needs access. For example, if I've moved, whether it's out of the agency or out of my job, and I no longer need access, the supervisor can do it as soon as I leave, and then definitely during one of those recertification programs.
Scott Davis is Acting Chief Information Security Officer at Customs and Border Protection. We'll return with the third and final segment of this interview after this short break. I'm Tom Temin.
President Biden's executive order on cybersecurity is a solid step toward creating a resilient cyber infrastructure for our nation. Okta and AWS can help agencies meet the cybersecurity executive mandates with a zero trust architecture that aligns to FedRAMP, NIST, and other standards. Together, Okta and AWS provide a vendor-neutral approach that enables MFA and identity management across endpoints, workflows, and supply chains. Learn more at okta.com/federal. That's okta.com/federal.
Welcome back to the third and final segment of our interview with Scott Davis, Acting Chief Information Security Officer at Customs and Border Protection. We've been discussing identity and access management. And getting back to the multi-factor authentication, then you mentioned that it tends to be the login.gov type of thing, not necessarily that for internal users, but where you get a one-time passcode that goes in addition to your, by the way, is CBP a CAC card company or just a PIV card operation?
PIV.
Okay.
We do have, so we have other partners. For example, we have some, not many, but we have some DOD, Department of Defense users. Well, theirs is a CAC, so it's very similar. It's a photo ID with a computer chip embedded in it and then a digital certificate on it. So we use a PIV. DOD uses a CAC. We do have some DOD users that access our systems, but it's ours is a PIV.
But in terms of the multiple factors, is biometrics part of the scheme or is it pretty much the other systems that generate codes and so forth that are, you know, good for 60 seconds or 5 minutes?
Right. So it's mainly the other systems such as, like I said, login.gov. We're not currently using biometrics.
And as a cybersecurity practitioner and someone that sees a lot of these programs to fruition, besides the IDAM, but we'll concentrate on identity and access management, where do you go for standards, guidance, NIST, and so forth? What are some of the bases on which you design the programs for security?
Well, you mentioned NIST, so the National Institute of Standards and Technology. The main standard that we utilize as far as identity is NIST 800-63B, which is the Digital Identity Guideline. It was published in 2017 and then I believe updated in 2020. So that's for identity management. That's the overarching one. And then, you know, I talked about PIVs. There's another NIST standard. It's a Federal Information Processing Standard, or FIPS. And so there's one that's 201-2, which is about PIVs. We also have DHS. So our headquarters has the 4300A, which is on securing systems, sensitive systems. And that's the mission directive. It covers a lot of different things, but identity and access management is a piece of that. And then, of course, there's specific CBP policies and things of that nature to talk about. Access management, identity management, who should get what access and what levels, and then requirements for annual cybersecurity training, for example. And if you're a privileged user, such as a system administrator or a database administrator, there's another round of training that goes into specific roles and requirements that are required to get those privileges. And that's, again, recurring training as well.
And also under the big tent, you also are a partner agency in that sense to the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, again, the big DHS tent. Do you get much from them, too? They've been, you know, pretty active in stepping up advice and patches and information to across the federal government.
Sure. So we work with CISA all the time. And so that's a partner of ours, whether it's with standards that they push out, but they also get alerts. So they monitor with their Einstein program, they monitor networks. But we also get information for alerts on the latest risks, threats, vulnerabilities, things of that nature. So they'll put out information, whether it's a requirement for reporting, requirement for patching, you mentioned, and the various activities that we need to make sure that we're as compliant and protected as possible. So we work with them. We also work, obviously, with our DHS headquarters. Ken Bible, the Chief Information Security Officer, we just had a call just yesterday discussing the cyber executive order that recently came out on improving the nation's cybersecurity. Some of the data calls that are coming out of that, whether it's for identity or the various components of just making sure that we're getting towards the protection that's being directed from the administration. So that executive order came out, I believe it was in May. Identity is actually one of the key foundation points within that executive order, as well as zero trust, supply chain risk management, things like that. But identity and identity access management would be a key piece of that, laying that foundation level to get to zero trust, which part of the zero trust architecture is presuming that you've been breached. So it's no longer perimeter facing. It's making sure that we're verifying identity and access internal and all the time. So it's continuous monitoring of those things. But we do work with CISA. They've given us, whether it's directives or, again, reporting and then alerts on risks and threats that are coming down.
And just a final question, what's the status of those CBP employees who normally would be in an office? Everyone's still mostly remote at this point in October?
Well, of course, we have people that can't work remotely.
Right.
out in the field and things, but the people that are like myself in IT, we are primarily working remotely at this time. There's a lot of a shift that happened across federal government as well as private sectors, you know, during COVID. But it's been a primarily remote work. We did have to shift a lot of different activities. Fortunately, CBP was well poised to enable people to work remotely, whether it was with the security and access management piece, identity, but also for Teams, for example, the communication that we utilize a lot. Zoom was utilized by headquarters a little bit, but we had the technology to enable people to do the things that they were able to do physically in the office. They are able to do remotely now, but primarily we're still in a remote work environment for the people who can do that. And of course, like I mentioned, you don't have people at the ports that can do that remotely. So,
Scott Davis, Acting Chief Information Security Officer at Customs and Border Protection. To hear this interview again or share it with colleagues, please visit federalnewsnetwork.com and search Federal Insights. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Federal Insights, sponsored by Okta on Federal News Network.
President Biden's executive order on cybersecurity is a solid step toward creating a resilient cyber infrastructure for our nation. Okta and AWS can help agencies meet the cybersecurity executive mandates with a zero-trust architecture that aligns to FedRAMP, NIST, and other standards. Together, Okta and AWS provide a vendor-neutral approach that enables MFA and identity management across endpoints, workflows, and supply chains. Learn more at okta.com/federal. That's okta.com/federal.
Hi, I'm Mike Richmond of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs with this VA research nugget. In the 1960s, VA undertook the first well-designed placebo-controlled trial to show whether medication can prevent death in those with moderate high blood pressure. The research led to a revolution in the care of people with hypertension. In 1964, Dr. Edward Fries and colleagues launched a VA study on antihypertensive agents. The study showed that drug treatment for moderate high blood pressure reduced patient deaths by over 50%. Previously, high blood pressure was considered a normal part of aging, and it was not known that treating high blood pressure could prevent death. In 1971, Fries received the prestigious Albert Lasker Award for his historic work on blood pressure treatment. To learn more about VA research, go to research.va.gov. That's research.va.gov. I'm Mike Richmond.